Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. You ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. And I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 or 13 times for a lease. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control, and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor, and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, that is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries, and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they get their hands on to incarcerate. And that's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
because I used to observe that a lot of little shacks used to be by the track where black people were.
With the room in the back.
Yes, with the room in the back. That was a safety net.
Yeah.
Where black people who would move here and there and go from here and there looking for jobs, that's usually why we move, and the jobs would play out like they always did.
And do.
But we had a place to go when the sun went down. But now, those shacks by the track don't exist anymore. They came and built highways right alongside of those railroad tracks where those shacks used to be. Super highways. So now, if you get on a highway, you might notice that if you, sometimes you are right alongside of a railroad track. You see trains passing
as
you're driving.
That is true.
Down a super highway.
Mm-hmm.
Well, see, those highways used not to be there in the northwestern hemisphere. It used to be shacks along there. A lot of those shacks were on what we call railroad property. But the railroad people, the people that ran the railroads, didn't care much because nobody wanted to be down. That wasn't prime real estate.
No.
Nobody wanted to be by the tracks anyway. So black people used to build little shacks around there back when black people knew how to build shacks. Black people don't know how to build anything now because they used to build places for white people, but they cut them off with things called unions, took them out, took the carpentry all out of the schools and all like that. So how many black people do you know that know how to fix anything now? It used to be thousands and millions of black people that know how to build a house from scratch out of old pieces of lumber.
Wow.
A lot of people don't remember that. Most people are not that old to have seen it done. Coming along, I'm old enough to remember when many black people used to get together on a Saturday afternoon. That was the only time they had off, or sometimes, or on a Sunday sometimes after church. Get together, six or eight of them, and go down and build what they call a shotgun house. It wasn't much, but it was a roof over your head, a good solid roof. I've been in some of those houses, raised up in some, all right? They were excellent, solid houses. They could stand a lot of storm and rain. They weren't much, just maybe three rooms. But I've been in some of them. And there were many, 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 many of them. But along came the white supremacists and say, these Negroes know how to build stuff. We're going to fix that so the next generation won't know how to do anything except stand in front of a place that is built and big. Because they won't know anything about carpentry or masonry or how to make anything with their hands.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, "Shoot it!" So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarion Styles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarion can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it, just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around, he saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he said, no, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you're having is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it's on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit, and it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Oh, no, you didn't. Wait a minute. No, you didn't.
Hey, Jay! Hey! Jay! 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 Come back here! Jay!
You disloyal, fool-ass, bitch-made punk.
Jay! I need my money! Jay!
Oh, you motherfuckers. Okay. All right. I'm putting cases on all you bitches. Huh? You think you can do this shit? Jay! You think you can do this to me? You motherfuckers will be playing basketball in Pelican Bay when I get finished with you. Shoe program, nigga. 23-hour lockdown. I'm the man up in this piece. You'll never see the light of day. Who the fuck you think you fucking with? I'm the police. I run shit here. You just live here. Yeah, that's right. You better walk away. Go and walk away, because I'm going to burn this motherfucker down. King Kong ain't got shit on me.
I'd like to take you to another world, and I'd like to share a 45-year-old love story with the poor living on less than $1 a day. I went to a very elitist, snobbish, expensive education in India, and that almost destroyed me. I was all set to be a diplomat, teacher, doctor, all laid out. I don't look it, but I was the Indian national squash champion for 3 years. The whole world was laid out for me. Everything was on my feet. Could do nothing wrong. And then I thought, out of curiosity, I'd like to go and live in a work and just see what a village is like. So in 1965, I went to what is called the worst Bihar famine in India, and I saw starvation, death, people dying of hunger for the first time. Changed my life. Came back home, told my mother, I'd like to live and work in a village. Mother went into a coma. What is this? The whole world is laid out for you, the best jobs are laying out for you, and you want to go and work in a village? I mean, is there something wrong with you? I said, no, I've got the best education, it made me think, and I wanted to give something back in my own way. What do you want to do in a village? No job, no money, no security, no prospect. I said, I want to live and dig wells for 5 years. Dig wells for 5 years? You went to the most expensive school and college in India and you want to dig wells for 5 years? She didn't speak to me for a very long time because she thought I'd let my family down. But then I was exposed to the most extraordinary knowledge and skills that very poor people have, which is never bought into mainstream, which is never identified, respected, applied on a large scale. And I thought I'd start a barefoot college only for the poor. What the poor thought was important would be reflected in the college. Went to this village for the first time. Elders came to me and said, are you running from the police? I said, no. You failed in your exam? I said, no. You didn't get a government job? I said, no. What are you doing here? Why are you here? The education system in India makes you look at Paris and Delhi and Zurich. What are you doing in this village? Is there something wrong with you? You're not telling us? He said, no. I want to actually start a college only for the poor. What the poor thought was important would be reflected in the college. So then they gave me some very sound and profound advice. They said, please, don't bring anyone with a degree and qualification into your college. So it's the only college in India where if you should have a PhD or a master's, you're disqualified to come. You have to be a cop-out or a washout or a dropout to come to our college. You have to work with your hands. You have to have a dignity of labor. You have to show that you have a skill that you can offer to to the community and provide a service to the community. So we started the Barefoot College, and we had redefined professionalism. Who is a professional? A professional is someone who has a combination of competence, confidence, and belief. A water diviner is a professional. A traditional midwife is a professional. A traditional bone setter is a professional. These are professionals all over the world. You'll find them in any inaccessible village around the world. And we thought that these people should come into mainstream and show that the knowledge and skills that they have is universal. It needs to be used, needs to be applied, needs to be shown to the world outside that these knowledge and skills are relevant even today. So the college works following the lifestyle and work style of Mahatma Gandhi. You eat on the floor, you sleep on the floor, you work on the floor. There are no contracts, no written contracts. You can stay with me for 20 years, go tomorrow. And no one can get more than $100 a month. You come for the money, you don't come to Barefoot College. You come for the work and the challenge, you come to the Barefoot College. That is where we want you to try crazy ideas. Whatever idea you have, come and try. Doesn't matter if you fail. Battered, bruised, you start again. It's the only college where the teacher is the learner and the learner is the teacher. And it's the only college we don't give a certificate. You are certified by the community you serve. You don't need a paper to hang on the wall to show that you are an engineer. So when they said that, they said, well, show us what is possible. What are you doing? This is all mumbo jumbo if you can't show it on the ground. So we built the first Barefoot College in 1986. It was built by 12 barefoot architects who can't read and write. Built on $1.50 a square foot. 150 people lived there, worked there. They got the Aga Khan Award for Architecture in 2002. But then they suspected, they thought there was an architect behind it. I said, yes, they made the blueprints, but the barefoot architect actually constructed the college. We are the only ones who actually returned the award for $50,000 because they didn't believe us and we thought that they were actually casting aspersions on the barefoot architects of Thelonia. I asked a forester, high-powered, paper-qualified expert, I said, what can you build in this place? He had one look at the soil and said, forget it, no way, nothing can work. No water, rocky soil. I was in a bit of a spot, and I said, okay, I'll go to the old man in the village and say, what should I grow in this spot? He looked quietly at me and said, you build this, you build this, you put this, and it'll work. This is what it looks like today. Went to the roof, and all the women said, clear out. The men should clear out because we don't want to share this technology with the men. This is waterproofing the roof. It is a bit of jaggery, bit of urine, a bit of other things I don't know, but it actually doesn't leak. Since 1986, it hasn't leaked. This technology, the women will not share with the men. It's the only college which is fully solar electrified. All the power comes from the sun. 45 kilowatts of panels on the roof and everything works out of the sun for the next 25 years. So long as the sun shines, I have no problem with power. But the beauty is, that it was installed by a priest, a Hindu priest who's only done 8 years of primary schooling. Never been to school, never been to college. He knows more about solar than anyone I know anywhere in the world. Guaranteed. Food, if you come to the Barefoot College, is solar cooked. But the people who fabricated that solar cooker are women, illiterate women, who actually fabricate the most sophisticated solar cooker. It's a parabolic Scheffler solar cooker. Unfortunately, they're almost half German. They're so precise. You'll never find Indian women so precise. Absolutely to the last inch. They can make that cooker, and we have 60 meals twice a day of solar cooking. We have a dentist. She's a grandmother, illiterate, who's a dentist. She actually looks after the teeth of 7,000 children. Therefore, technology, this was 1986, no engineer, no architect thought of it, but we are collecting rainwater from the roofs. Very little water is wasted. All the roofs are connected underground to a 400,000 liter tank, and no water is wasted. If we have 4 years of drought, we still have water in the campus because we collect rainwater. 60% of children don't go to school because they have to look after animals, sheep, goats, domestic chores. So we thought of starting a school at night for the children. We call the night schools of Thelonia. Over 75,000 children have gone through these night schools because it's for the convenience of the child, it's not for the convenience of the teacher. And what do we teach in these schools? Democracy, citizenship, how you should measure your land, what you should do if you're arrested, what you should do if your animal is sick. This is what we teach in the night schools. But all the schools are solar lit. Every 5 years, we have an election between 6 to 14-year-old children participate in a democratic process, and they elect a prime minister. The prime minister is 12 years old. He looks after 20 goats in the morning, but she's prime minister in the evening. She has a cabinet, Minister for Education, Minister for Energy, Minister for Health, and they actually monitor and supervise 150 schools for 7,000 children. She got the World's Children's Prize 5 years ago, and she went to Sweden. First time ever going out of a village, never seen Sweden, wasn't dazzled at all by what was happening. And the Queen of Sweden, who's there, turned to me and said, can you ask this child where she got her confidence from? She's only 12 years old, and she's not dazzled by anything. And the girl who's on her left turned to me and looked at the Queen straight in the eye and said, please tell her I'm the Prime Minister. Where the percentage of illiteracy is very high, we use puppetry. Puppet is the way we communicate. You have Joachim Chacha, who's 300 years old. He's my psychoanalyst, he's my teacher, he's my doctor, he's my lawyer, he's my donor. He actually raises money, solves my disputes. He solves my problems in the village. If there's tension in the village, if the attendance in the schools go down and there's a friction between the teacher and the parent, the puppet calls the teacher and the parent in front of the whole village and says, shake hands, the attendance must not drop. These puppets are made out of recycled World Bank reports. So this decentralized, demystified approach of solar electrifying villages, we've covered all over India, from Ladakh up to Bhutan. All solar electrified villages by people who have been trained. When we went to Ladakh and we asked this woman, this at minus 40, you have to come out of the roof because there's no place, it's all snowed up on both sides. And we asked this woman, what was the benefit you had from solar electricity? And she thought for a minute and said, it's the first time I can see my husband's face in winter. Went to Afghanistan. One lesson we learned in India was, men are untrainable. Men are restless, men are ambitious, men are compulsively mobile, and they all want a certificate. All across the globe you'll have this tendency of men wanting a certificate. Why? Because they want to leave the village and go to a city looking for a job. So we came up with a great solution. Train grandmothers. What's the best way of communicating in the world today. Television? No. Telegraph? No. Telephone? No. Tell a woman. So we went to Afghanistan for the first time. And we picked three women and said, we want to take them to India. They said, impossible. They don't even go out of their room, then you want to take them to India. I said, I'll make a concession. I'll take the husbands along as well. So I took the husbands along. Of course, the women were much more intelligent than the men. In 6 months, how do we train these women? Sign language. You don't use the written word. You don't use the spoken word. You use sign language. And in 6 months, they can become solar engineers. They go back and solar electrify their own village. This woman went back and solar electrified the first village, set up a workshop. The first village ever to be solar electrified in Afghanistan were by the three women. This woman is an extraordinary grandmother, 55 years old, and she solar electrified 200 houses for me in Afghanistan, and they haven't collapsed. She actually went and spoke to an engineering department in Afghanistan and told the head of a department the difference between AC and DC. Didn't know. Those three women have trained 27 more women and solar electrified 100 villages in Afghanistan. We went to Africa and we did the same thing. All these women sitting in one table from 8-9 countries, all chatting to each other, not understanding a word because they're all speaking the different language. But their body language is great. They're speaking to each other and actually becoming solar engineers. I went to Sierra Leone, and there was this minister driving down at the dead of night, comes across this village, comes back, goes into the village and says, well, what's the story? They said, these two grandmothers. Grandmothers? Minister couldn't believe what was happening. Where did they go? Went to India and back. Went straight to the president. He said, do you know there's a solar electrified village in Sierra Leone? He said, no. Half the cabinet went to see the grandmother the next day. What's the story? So he summoned me and said, can you train me 150 grandmothers? I said, I can't, Mr. President, but they will. The grandmothers will. So he built me the first barefoot training center in Sierra Leone. And 150 grandmothers are being trained in Sierra Leone. Gambia. I went to select the grandmother in Gambia. Went to this village, I knew which woman I would like to take. The community got together and said, I'll take these two women. I said, no, I'm going to take this woman. They said, why? She doesn't know the language, you don't know her. I said, no, I like the body language, I like the way she speaks. Difficult husband, not possible. Call the husband. Husband came. Swaggering, politician, mobile in his hand, not possible. Why not? The woman, look how beautiful she is. I said, yeah, she's very beautiful. What happens if she runs off with an Indian man? That was the biggest fear. I said, she'll be happy. She'll ring up in a mobile. She went like a grandmother and came back like a tiger. She walked out of the plane and spoke to the whole press as if she was a veteran. She handled the national press and she was a star. And when I went back 6 months later, I said, where's your husband? Oh, somewhere, doesn't matter. Somebody. Success story. I'll just wind up by saying that I think you don't have to look for solutions outside. Look for solutions within and listen to people. They have the solutions in front of you. They're all over the world. Don't even worry. Don't listen to the World Bank. Listen to the people on the ground. They have all the solutions in the world. I'll end with a quotation by Mahatma Gandhi. First they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, and then you win. Thank you.
Hey, Bobby, why do you like soul food?
Because it makes me happy.
Pass the peas like you used to say. Pass the peas like you used to say. Pass the peas like you used to say. Pass the peas like you used to say.
God damn, left in his hand. The butcher is a monster. Good God, he's not a natural man. The dealer for nickel ought to sell you lots of sweet dreams. I've got the butcher on your body.
I'd like to begin with a question. Why the heck is a rabbi talking about Batman? I should be involved with spirituality and not spandex. To answer the question, I'll have to make a confession. Not that rabbis usually confess, but unlike many of my rabbinical contemporaries, I did not grow up religious, observant, orthodox, Hasidic, Chabad. For want of a better word, I grew up normal. I'm from Manchester, England, and growing up in Manchester, religion was spiritual Valium. It was something that others needed to get answers to existential questions in life that really had no answers. I was a superhero zealot, and a degree in film history led to a job scouting movie locations. Yet, to quote the old Yiddish proverb, man plans, God laughs. Seeking to fulfill needs not met by MTV and materialism, I became a rabbi, like you do. Today, I chair the Religious Affairs Committee at the renowned New York Art School Pratt Institute, When I first became the rabbi of Pratt, I tried all the traditional rabbinic shtick, Sabbath, kosher, holiday. I still try. And students would say to me, Rabbi Simcha, you're a great guy. You're funny, dynamic, erudite, extremely handsome. Whatever. But this is art school. Ironically, at Pratt, I found myself at the very same school that many comic book pioneers once attended. And I started to reread the classic superhero comics of my youth, this time through the lens of Jewish tradition and spirituality. I wrote my first book, Up, Up, and Oyvey. It was a direct collaboration over copious bowls of chicken soup at 3 o'clock in the morning with my students, the premise of the book being that every single major figure that has created the all-American superhero was Jewish. In fact, you can even say, if a person's name ends in man, they're either Jewish, Lippmann, Feldman, Goldman, or a superhero, Superman. I'm not even going to finish that. Which begs the obvious question, why did Jews create superheroes? The answer is sad, succinct, and simple. The late 1930s were arguably the most anti-Semitic period in American history. Many Ivy League schools kept a quota on the number of Jews allowed, country clubs, and even some neighborhoods barred Jews altogether. Comic books were in their infancy. They were the lowest rung on the artistic food chain. There was no barriers to entry. Through the prism of Jewish storytelling and the immigrant experience, comic book creators infused their creations with a particularly Jewish worldview. Take Superman, the creation of two Jews, Jerry Siegel and Joseph Shuster from Cleveland, Ohio. In Superman number 2 from 1939, Superman is sent to an unnamed European location. He meets Adolphus Runyon, a thinly veiled metaphor for Hitler. He's put in an ancient pillared room. Superman knocks the pillars and shouts, "A man named Samson once tried to do this." Here you see young immigrant Jews tapping into a storytelling tradition rich in biblical archetypes. After all, writers write about what they know about. Also, consider the Jewish immigrant experience. Many comic book creators came from unassimilated Yiddish-speaking homes. They had one identity at home, another identity at work. They create characters who themselves have one identity at home, another identity at work. Think about Batman's creator, Bob Kane, was born Robert Kahn. Captain America's creator, Jack Kirby, was born Jacob Kurtzberg. Stan Lee, the man behind everything, was born Stanley Lieber. It's no wonder Pulitzer Prize-winning author Michael Shaibon once noted, it's impossible not to see these things as allegorical of the Jewish immigrant experience. Also consider patriotism. 6 months before Pearl Harbor thrusted America into World War II, Jack Kirby and Joe Simon had taken matters into their own hands with Captain America. The front cover of Captain America number 1 sees Captain America smashing Hitler across the face, knocking the Fuhrer to the ground. It's cute, it's funny, it's nostalgic. Could you imagine coming from immigrant Jews who were getting wretching letters home from their families in the old country? What a powerful portrayal of wish fulfillment this must have been. The end of World War II saw a brief decline in the popularity of superheroes. After all, peacetime proved bad for business. But by the swinging 60s, superheroes had evolved. They became complex, ambiguous, flawed, and reluctant, with their own angst and insecurities to deal with. In 1961, Stan Lee and Jack Kirby create a different type of superhero. They create a family of superheroes called the Fantastic Four. One particular character called the Thing, who has a rock-like substance over his body, was very Jewish from the beginning. In fact, in the comics, the Thing's name is Benjamin Jacob Grimm. Can there be a more Jewish-sounding name than Benjamin Jacob? Jack Kirby was born Jacob, named after the famous patriarch who spends the night wrestling an angel. In the comics, the Thing grows up on Yancey Street, a very thinly veiled nod to the iconography of the tenements of Delancey Street in a 2002 edition. The thing goes back to Yancey Street, and his Semitic roots are revealed. He sees Mr. Schekkerberg, who he thinks has died. The thing stands over him and says the Shema, the most famous of all Jewish prayers. He opens the F of the Fantastic Four belt buckle. He pulls out a Magen David, a Star of David necklace. Like so many of his American tribesmen, the thing hid his Jewish roots in order to avoid confrontation. Ironically, Manhattan's Cosmic Comic put a sign in the window after the issue was released asking, how do you circumcise an orange brick? Google it. Another reoccurring theme we see is the Jewish immigrant experience. In 1962, Stan Lee and Jack Kirby collaborate on The Incredible Hulk. Hulk's a metaphor for many things: Cuban Missile Crisis, fear of genetic mutation, the atomic bomb. He's also based on the Golem, the famous monster hero from 16th century Prague, created to defend the Jewish community from pogrom. Interestingly, in the 70s, they write an issue called In the Shadow of the Golem, where the Hulk is mistaken to be the Golem. Another reoccurring theme we see is the Holocaust. Whilst earlier generations of comic book creators grappled with the Holocaust, later generations grapple with the aftermath. In 1963, Stan Lee, Jack Kirby collaborate on the most serious comic of them all. It's not a solitary superhero, not a dynamic duo, not a fantastic foursome, but an entire race of superheroes called the X-Men. And who better to base that race on than their own people, the Jewish people? We can see a tragic Holocaust connection in the character of Magneto, the anti-hero who in the comics has to help the Nazis kill his own family to stay alive. That makes him a tragic, yet somehow understandable anti-hero. In the 80s, the X-Men introduce the Jewish character of Kitty Pryde, who lights a Yahrzeit remembrance candle when her fellow mutant and sometimes boyfriend Colossus is killed. I'm not sure what halacha says when your mutant alien boyfriend is killed. That's above my pay grade. Make a great Eli talk. Finally, in closing, I'd like to ask a very simple question. Is Superman Jewish? No one knows more about this than I do, because no one is as meshuggah enough as to think about this as much as I have. We know his creators were Jewish. We know he's based on an assimilated archetype. However, he's also based on Moses. For those of you that were awake during Sunday school, you may remember the story. Egypt faces internal implosion. Moses is put in a reed basket. He's sent away, grows up in a foreign culture, foreign land. The house of Pharaoh becomes the savior of humanity. What's the story of Superman? Krypton faces internal implosion. Baby Kal-El, which is Hebrew for the voice or vessel of God, is put in a little rocket pod. He's sent away to a foreign culture, foreign land, grows up in a Midwestern cornfield with the Kent family, and becomes the savior of humanity. The suffix El being one of the names of God used in the Bible. It's also the name of the prophets, Michael, Daniel, Emmanuel. Tragically, the story happened for real. In the late 30s, early 40s, as young Jewish children were being shepherded on to Kindertransport, sent away to live in safety as the old country imploded with families in England. So, the question, is Superman, or for that matter, any superhero Jewish? The answer is a loud, clear, resounding, emphatic no. Jews are not superheroes, and superheroes are not Jewish. However, superhero values are Jewish values. So next time you're chewing on the popcorn, watching Star Spangled Salvation in 3D, of course, remember the following. Every single one of us hides behind an assimilated archetype, a mild-mannered Clark Kent. But go out into the world without any masks. Be superheroes in spandex or not. Thank you.
The story is told of three men lost, wandering through a desert. One of the men is Russian, another one is a Frenchman, and the third man is a Jewish man. They're wandering through this desolate desert, and the Russian man says, "My throat is dry. I'm thirsty. I wish I had vodka." The Frenchman says, "My throat is dry. I'm thirsty. I wish I had champagne." And the Jewish man says, "My throat is dry. I'm thirsty. I probably have diabetes." That is a joke that I think works with almost every demography of the Jewish people, because it says something about us and our culture.
One in a Million, the history of Madam C.J. Walker and her entrepreneurial legacy. Not even her poor and difficult beginnings stymied Madam Walker's road to greatness. Born December 23, 1867, roughly 2 years after the alleged emancipation of her race, she was an orphan at 7, a wife at 14, a mother at 17, and a widow by 20. The woman who would become known as the first self-made female millionaire and the greatest benefactress of her race was born the daughter of Owen and Minerva Breedlove, poor ex-slaves living on a cotton farm in Louisiana. They named their special little girl Sarah Breedlove. A washerwoman by trade, at the age of 33 in 1900, Sarah began selling a product door to door which she had formulated to remedy her own hair loss. She pinpointed the root of her hair problems, which was the scalp, and created hair care products and a beauty regimen for hair growth and maintenance that focused on the need for a clean and healthy scalp, scalp protection, and scalp stimulation for maximum hair growth. Her first product would eventually be called Madam C.J. Walker's Wonderful Hair Grower, and she boldly and proudly used her own likeness on her jars and her own before and after pictures to demonstrate her product's effectiveness. Per Madam's own words, she abhorred the impression held by some that she claimed to straighten hair. She emphatically stated, "I grow hair," and that there would be no hair-growing business today had I not started it. She described her concept and method of hair growth as beauty culture because she compared growing hair to growing and cultivating garden plants. She then broadened this concept of beauty culture by incorporating the value of cleanliness and professionalism, which emphasized the overall appearance, moral conduct, and character of the Black woman. Black women from all over the country began writing letters to Madam Walker attesting to the benefits of her products. By setting up a special correspondence course of beauty culture in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and then a manufacturing facility in Indiana, and later a beauty college in New York City, Madam was able to further establish and promulgate her program of beauty culture, which trained the Black female in three areas. First, the Black woman was taught the proper presentation of herself. She was to be clean, neat, properly attired, and well-mannered. Second, she was taught how to use Madam's hair care system on customers. And third, she was taught how to sell Madam's hair care products to customers. In so doing, Madam C.J. Walker provided a solution to the root of the Black woman's demise. She raised the Black woman's self-esteem and confidence about her own beauty and intelligence, and she empowered the Black woman economically, thus freeing her from white servitude and male dependency. This accomplishment is even more amazing when put in the context of the time in which these things were done and in the context of Madam's own background. The time, one historian called the nadir, or lowest point in the history of the Black race outside of slavery itself. The blessings of freedom was now marred by the blatant terrorist acts of the Ku Klux Klan and those like-minded individuals working in collusion with them. The harsh reality faced by the vast majority of blacks living in this era was that the number of lynchings peaked during the early 1900s, as did other backlashes sparked by Reconstruction, such as the burning of black churches and schools and the establishment of Jim Crow laws. During this dark period, most black women were either sharecroppers or washerwomen and house servants for whites. Madam Walker was no exception, but she was, however, exceptional. Madam Walker moved her ever-expanding special correspondence course business, founded on her system of beauty culture, to Indianapolis, Indiana, on February 19, 1910. She then purchased and paid for her home, adjoining which was a factory and laboratory, located at 640 North West Street. She endeared herself to the citizens of Indianapolis when she contributed $1,000 to the establishment of the Senate Avenue YMCA. It is reported that she was the only woman to make such a donation. Madam herself, when referring to the YMCA donation, had this to say, quote, "In referring to that $1,000 gift, I don't want you to lay so much stress on it, and do not say that I am the only one. You might say that I was the first and caused others to awaken to the sense of their duty in helping deserving causes for the benefit of the race," end quote. Not long after her move to Indianapolis, Madam Walker also became a member of Bethel AME Church, one of the oldest and most influential churches in the black community, to which Madam Walker contributed generously. In less than 2 years after moving to Indianapolis, on September 2, 1911, Madam C.J. Walker petitioned the Indiana Secretary of State to become incorporated, and on September 19, 1911, exactly 1 year and 7 months since her arrival in Indianapolis, the Madam C.J. Walker Manufacturing Company of Indiana Incorporated was established, Madam Walker naming herself president and owner of all 1,000 shares of stock. A relentless worker and ingenious marketer and saleswoman, Madam Walker had thought to place her system of hair care products in black colleges all across the United States. She also regularly advertised in black newspapers, and she eventually placed her products in drugstores. As she traveled throughout the country, she wrote letters to her general manager in order to instruct him on how best to run her factory in her absence and how to implement all of her new ideas. However, the Madam Walker agents, Madam's recruited sales force, were her biggest asset. Madam held public meetings in churches, rented lodge halls and other such facilities, and put on demonstrations, including a slide presentation, in order to recruit black women to become Walker agents. Madam Walker taught and trained them in the methods of application and proper use of her hair oils and vegetable shampoo. Eventually, Madam organized a national convention for her Walker agents, giving away prizes and other incentives to motivate and energize her ever-growing troops of Walker agents. Sales generated from Madam Walker's manufacturing company and the hair care products it produced enabled Madam to give birth to yet another legacy, as Madam became known as the greatest benefactress of her race. Through monies earned and derived from Madam's work in the hair-growing business, Madam Walker regularly donated large sums of money to charity and to individuals of her race who were in need. In fact, Madam was so self-sacrificing and freely giving that those closest to her were worried that she would become financially ruined. Desiring all blacks to have decent homes, at times, Madam would assume mortgages of blacks who were financially strapped, allowing them to repay when and how they could. Various schools for blacks and certain social and civic organizations dedicated to the betterment of the black race were also beneficiaries of Madam's philanthropy. Though many have called Madam extravagant, Her generosity and passion for her people were Madam's only extravagances. She gave not for self-aggrandizement, but rather to inspire other wealthy blacks to give likewise. Moreover, Madam's giving went well beyond monetary donations. She lent her name and time to worthy causes. She traversed the country, speaking against lynchings, and fought vehemently for the fair treatment of black soldiers who had served in America's military during World War I. Madam C.J. Walker was an ambassador of sorts, a spokesperson for all black-skinned people, a revolutionary, visionary, missionary force. It should therefore be quite obvious that Madam Walker's passing on May 25, 1919, was a tremendous loss to the black race. At that time, Madam had recruited over 25,000 black women from the United States, Central America, and the Caribbean as door-to-door beauty culturists and was well on her way to Africa. Her net worth was over $1 million, making her the first female, regardless of color, to become a self-made millionaire. She is one of the most successful black entrepreneurs of all time and one of the first to utilize the method known today as direct sales marketing to distribute her products. She had also managed to build a 32-room mansion in Irvington, New York called Villa Loaro, which she had desired to be left as a monument to her name and as an example to her race of what hard work and black support of black enterprises could achieve. After Madam's 1919 passing, her hair care manufacturing corporation was used as collateral to secure the finances needed to build what is today known as the Madam Walker Theater Building. Completed in late 1927, the Walker Building Beauty Salon continues to operate there and continues to sell Madam C.J. Walker's original hair care products. Years later, in 1982, the trustees of Madam Walker's trust would deposit a large portion of Madam C.J. Walker Manufacturing Company's business records, historical documents, pictures, and memorabilia with the Indiana Historical Society, who took on the task of painstakingly organizing and preserving the Madam Walker legacy. 74 years after the incorporation of the Madam Walker Company, in 1985, the 1,000 shares of capital stock of Madam's corporation were sold to a man named Raymond L. Randolph, making him the first person since Madam Walker herself to own all 1,000 shares of stock in the original Madam Walker Company. A graduate of Attucks High School, Mr. Randolph had never dreamed that he would become the owner and caretaker of this phenomenal legacy. In honor of Madam C.J. Walker, Mr. Randolph placed Madam Walker's image back on the jars of her original hair care products with the words, "Since 1911," placed underneath it. Doing business today as Madam C.J. Walker Enterprises Incorporated, the hair care company founded by Madam C.J. Walker continues to manufacture and sell her original quality products, ensuring that the legacy of this remarkable woman never dies. The Madam Walker Agent Program has been reinstituted and is the main method by which her products are distributed today. On September 24, 2011, Madam C.J. Walker Enterprises sponsored a centennial celebratory walk called Tracing the Footsteps of a Legacy. This event marked the 100th year since the pivotal point in her entrepreneurial legacy when Madam Walker incorporated her manufacturing company, the Madam C.J. Walker business family, which includes the Madam Walker agents, will continue to keep Madam Walker's spirit alive and well by ensuring that her labor of love, her manufacturing business, continues operating according to the entrepreneurial blueprint she left behind and which is detailed in the historical documents of the company. Thank you. Thank you, Sarah Breedlove. You are indeed one in a million.
there's some comparisons, or parallels rather, between Hollywood, particularly the origins of Hollywood, and Sarah Breedlove, better known as Madam C.J. Walker. And I'm throwing Bill Cosby, too. Let's start off with Hollywood. Hollywood was originally organized by five Eastern European Jewish people. They formed their own film community. It wasn't stated like that publicly, but in actuality, that's what it was. They didn't want to be, because prior to Hollywood as we know it today, Thomas Edison in New Jersey controlled the film industry. But they wanted to get far away from New Jersey and Edison, thus Southern California. So you have five Jewish men of Eastern European, and they formed their own film community. They didn't wait on the government. They didn't wait on reparations and none of that kind of stuff. This is documented, by the way. They started their own film community. So, and they built or created characters through comic books, radio shows, silent movies, and talking movies that portrayed them in a positive, matter of fact, the word I need to use is identity. As stated in the audio right before this last one we played with about Madam C.J. Walker, their comic book characters, which were eventually put on film in their movie theaters and on TV sets, all their creators were Jewish, but practically all of them were Jewish, definitely Superman. And the identity of those characters were superhuman. I mean, Superman could fly. Bullets would bounce off him, jump buildings in a single bound. The Fantastic Four. A lot of those comic books during that era, which are collector items now, and I guess they got new ones coming out. But, even movies, Batman and all that, strong identities, superhuman, and all positive. Now, once again, Jewish writers, Jewish creators, Jewish studios, they didn't try to get in on nobody else's hustle. They weren't talking about, discrimination. They didn't march for equal rights. They didn't march for or protest. Or what did Martin Luther King say? One of them marches with Martin Luther King. We come to get our check. None of that. They created their own identity, a strong identity, multiple identities in their own community. Even the Oscars is basically a platform for, now once again, looking at the root of Hollywood, which is Jewish. Okay. But anybody can, they'll take anybody's money to watch one of their films. Okay. But that was and still is an award ceremony so they can recognize their greatness. Now, of course, for political correctness. You know, anybody can get in there now. But I'm just saying, that's what they started proactively on their own. And a lot of your Hollywood stars of the golden era of Hollywood were Jewish. Now, as a credit, I got to give Bill Cosby credit, because Bill Cosby, through his cartoons, you know, Fat Albert, he put out products that had a positive overall portrayal of black kids and black people, including his TV show. So he did the cartoon thing as well as, you know, the TV shows, I Spy. That wasn't his production, but he was in it. But the Cosby Show, and he had two Cosby shows, which, you know, and then, of course, he did movies as well. And he had a proactive approach to doing it. He didn't wait on the government or march or protest. He just organized his money, and I'm sure he probably had some social capital in there for funding to put those projects on. Madam C.J. Walker, she was proactive. Let me correct one thing. Madam C.J. Walker was not the first black female millionaire. There were other women, black, like Bridget Biddy Mason, who was born a slave. She was a millionaire before Madam C.J. Walker. And Mary Pleasant, I think her name, out of the Bay Area. Mary Pleasant, I think Mary Ellen Pleasant, another black woman, she was also a millionaire before Madam C.J. Walker. And then Madam C.J. Walker's mentor, the woman who taught her the business, Annie Malone, she was a millionaire, and she taught not only Madam C.J. Walker, but there were other black women also. So for some reason, I don't know why they just always pick Madam C.J. Walker, but anyway. And you can read up on, look up Annie Malone. Look up Annie Malone. There's a picture of her, a whole Wikipedia page on other stuff. Read about her. She was the person that Sarah Breedlove modeled and morphed into Madam C.J. Walker. So but going back to Madam C.J. Walker, she did have her face, you know, a positive identity on her hair care products. And I didn't know they were still in production, but I'm going to have to check that out. Because she did have she offered a very positive identity towards the, particularly when she was living at the time, and because she had quite a few salespeople. As far as where it's the Philippines, I believe, in Southeast Asia, that marketed her product. So that's my rant on it. And that's all part of, because today's podcast is titled Limitless. Okay, Limitless. So Madam C.J. Walker had an unlimited mindset. And Hollywood, a lot of those characters had, I mean, they were not limited. They were limitless. So that's my rant on that. Tomorrow, we shall have back on tomorrow, we'll have Chris Collins, and we'll have a couple other people in as well. And we're going to pick up where we left off. So tune in for that. Now, other than that, that's all my info for today. If you guys have any news, information, trending topics that you want to put out there, now's the time to do it. 619-768-2945. If not, well, that's all we have for today. I'll say unless you guys have something. So, all right. We'll revisit the identity thing later. Well, we do have a caller here. 410, your mic is open. 410. I think your mic is muted, though.
Hotel Brother L.A., how are you doing this morning?
Fine, fine. Good to hear your voice. What's on your mind?
Well, maybe I should say this afternoon, rather.
Oh, yeah, well, it is afternoon now, yeah.
Standard
here it
time.
Is. Yeah.
I was just listening to, I'm going back and listening to your radio broadcast yesterday. That was very interesting. I didn't get it all because I was back and forth taking care of some things. That was a very interesting gentleman that you had over there, up there yesterday. I don't remember who he was, but...
Chris Collins.
You know, very enlightening.
Now,
where did you
now,
find him?
On Clubhouse. I wasn't, what's the day? Went, no, today's Tuesday. Last Friday, in the 7 o'clock hour, I was in a room, in Clubhouse, they call them rooms. And the room was Unleash Your Potential. That's the name of the room there on Clubhouse. And, oh, man, what was the topic? I think it was... what's more important, action or knowledge? And he was in there, you know, they let everybody go around the room and had their say on it. So that's how I met him in that room. And, I, you know, he's a builder. He's way ahead of me. But I said, well, hey, I like to interview on a podcast, so. We had him on yesterday. So that's how I ran across him.
I tell you what, I mean, he's really a forward-thinking guy. I mean, I was very impressed.
Well, yeah, a few people thought that way.
I guess you and he are of the same mindset because the thing is, it seems like he has an answer to a lot of the things that's out here that's really affecting people. I don't know how far he's gotten or where his projects are located at, but, you know, I'm going to listen to it again. I just couldn't believe what I was hearing.
Well, he said quite a bit. We had him on for like 2 hours and 5 minutes. Well, about an hour, about 90 minutes of that was solid show, though. But, yeah, quite a few people, he'll be back tomorrow.
Okay.
But, yeah, we're going to have some offline projects with him. Offline events,
okay.
Which people will be able to attend. Hopefully in a location near you.
Oh, okay. Okay. So
yeah,
he's already done some projects, huh?
Yeah, yeah. He's done quite a few. So
are you familiar with some of his projects or been to some of them?
No, I haven't. Like I said, I just ran across him Friday. But he's out of Illinois. And one of his partners is a guy that I've been sort of shadowing for the last 4 or 5 years, maybe 6. So he's legit. And like I said, I plan on I want to beta test with him two on-the-ground projects, events.
Oh, okay.
But like I said, we haven't talked about that aspect of it. Probably something here in Florida and then something up there in Illinois. And then depending on those, how they turn out, then if, you know, people have interest in different parts of the country, then we'll set up events in those parts of the country as well. I know one thing he put out there that kind of surprised me, that with Habitat for Humanity, some of those people end up in foreclosure. They end up losing the house. So, but he was correct on it. I checked it out. He was right. And I know for also, now this before I even knew he existed, Habitat for Humanity, depending on the city that they do these homes, is, in my opinion, a lot of those homes aren't affordably priced. That's just my opinion. Anyway, but we'll probably get more on that tomorrow.
Yeah, yeah. I've seen two of those projects in my area. They're very strictly controlled. I thought, you know, because. But now, you know, as far as I'm concerned, the people that got them, I think they missed an opportunity. But the way I looked at the way the loans were structured, I had some, you know, some reservations about it. But I guess when you need a house, that's the best way to go. You know, as far as I'm concerned, I don't know a lot about it, but I just know that.
Right.
Two of the houses in my area, they put them up, and one girl lost hers because of negligence, and the other one house went in foreclosure because the people that built them for died. So I don't know, but I haven't really looked into it, so I don't know. I got to listen to your program to see what he says about it.
All right. Well, I'm from the Amish and Mennonite school of thought. Build them with no mortgage. But a lot of the Habitat houses, those are, I mean, they got Habitat houses in Baltimore. You know.
I've seen one. I don't know of any others. I've seen one.
But they weren't, in my opinion, they weren't built. I forgot what street that is on, because they haven't been in Baltimore in a while. One of the main streets up in Baltimore, but They weren't built inexpensively. I mean, those houses were actually rehabbed. They weren't built from the ground. They took a vacant house that needed work, and they rehabbed it. And the price tag on the house, in my opinion, wasn't affordably priced. But that's, I don't know how the whole thing with Habitat worked, but.
Yeah, I need to look into it. Now, the ones down here, they build them from scratch with new material. I guess because we're out in the rural area, you know, they just put them up with brand new material. But you got to keep them so long before you can do anything with them. But this girl that I know, her house payments was only $200 a month.
That's reasonable.
With the loan.
That's very reasonable.
Yeah, and the thing is, to show you how we work in our neighborhoods, she couldn't make a $200 a month house payment, but she lost a house, and she went and rented a single-wire trailer for $600 a month.
That's crazy. Now, what is going on in your life?
I don't know. I can't figure that out. Well, now she did like drugs. But look, even with her, she was on a job with me one time. I mean, she just wouldn't pay her house note. And the thing is, when I found out her house note was only $200, and she was, after she got thrown out of the house, she went and got in a trailer park, rented a trailer for $600. I was thinking maybe her bread's not done. You know, because...
It sounds like it. And you say she had a drug, involved in drugs or something?
Yeah,
that
she,
could be
Well, now, she was functional because she's working now, but what happened is she wasn't a hard drug user. She just loved to smoke weed, you know, but if you can't afford $200 a month, I mean, Brother L.A., come on. You know?
Look, there's Section 8 people. There's Section 8 people who have been evicted over not paying their $5 a month rent.
Well, I know a girl that couldn't pay a dollar a month. But you know, there's
now,
something
you know, the problem with those people, the backstory on a lot of those people that for $1 or $5 that get evicted, a lot of those people have a lot of drama in their life. So more than likely there's some kind of drama, destruction of property, illegal activity that goes on in those lives, and the landlord, who gets the lion's share of the rent from the government, they say, you know what, it's better that I just get rid of them. Because when I had Section 8, if they didn't have their portion, I often overlook it.
Well, I don't overlook it, but the thing is, I let them know straight up, hey, look, you got a good thing here. You might as well keep it. I talk to them quite a bit. But,
right.
Brother L.A., if you can't pay your portion of subsidized rent, there's something wrong with you. I mean, I just don't understand it. You know, I haven't been able to read these people very well. I don't know what the problem is. I just don't. But that's
what's
going on.
Well, you have a different mindset. We have a different mindset. Well, like some of them could be on substance abuse. Some of them is generational. It's the family mindset. Some of them have an entitlement mindset. But you got to look. I mean, some of them, they know how to use the system where they don't have to come out of their pocket, or they come out very little. Like I had one Section 8 tenant. Their portion was like $35 a month, but they were drug addicts. So I came over there looking, you know, for the rent, and a husband, or her man, father of her kids, he will say, you really don't need that money, do you? See, you know, that's how they think. That's how some of them think.
Yeah. But I was just amazed. Well, look, I'm going to get off. I'm going to get off because I know you got things to do. But look, have you? I'm going to end on this one. Have you read S.B. Fuller's story?
What
Samuel
I know
B.
about
Fuller.
Him? Full of products.
Right.
Here's what I know about him. I know he owned a black newspaper too. At one time, was the wealthiest black person in the United States. He didn't start from scratch. There was another black woman that lived in New York or something. I forgot the woman's name. He bought her company and then put his name on it, rebranded it, you know, to Fuller Products. And he was very successful with it. And then Joe Dudley Sr. Became his protege. Now, I don't know, because Fuller, he got sick or whatever, and the company was in the financial problems in some kind of I don't know how, you know, because it went from Fuller products got absorbed into Dudley products, and that's all I know about S.B. Fuller.
The reason why I bring his name up, number one, he is your male counterpart to Maggie Malone and I'm sorry, what's her name?
Madam C.J. Walker.
Yeah, and C.J. Walker. What's Malone's name? Annie Malone.
Yeah, Annie Malone.
He's the male counterpart to them. And also, what happened to him back in the 50s and 60s is the same thing that's happening to Kanye West. Now, I'm going to send you the write-up on it. But
speaking of Kanye, what do you think's happening with Kanye now? Because I'm behind on Kanye news.
Well, you know he made some so-called controversial statements, right?
Yeah, and I got to go watch some video on that. Now, the only thing I've seen on him so far within the last week, because I wasn't looking, was Jamie Lee Curtis. Somebody asked her about some tweets that Kanye made, and she didn't badmouth him, but she said she was just very hurt and wish she would get help or something. I'm paraphrasing now. And then somebody pulled their endorsement from whatever Kanye was selling, whatever. That's all I know. I need to find out what he said.
Well, I'm gonna let you go. And the thing is this, S.B. Fuller's story really is the same thing that's happening to Kanye West now. You know that Kanye West is worth about
$2 to $3 billion. Now, this is what I heard, what I had with Fuller. Now, I read this in John H. Johnson's book, the guy who started Ebony and Jet magazine. In his book, Succeeding Against the Odds, Fuller at one time had white agents selling for him, too. But once they found out that Fuller was black, quit the company. And some of them badmouthed him as well. And that's paraphrasing what Johnny Johnson said.
Right, but guess who started the whole S.B. Fuller's downfall?
I have no idea. Don't tell me Dudley now.
No, Dudley came back and helped him revitalize the country, but S.B. Fuller was a proponent of self-help, like Booker T. Washington.
Was.
And he made a speech.
And he was a Republican as well.
Yeah, he was a Republican too. And which, you know, Republicans back then is like the black Democrats today. The Republican Party was more or less liberal until the Dixiecrats got in there and changed it to conservative. But anyway, what happened is he made a statement that the NAACP didn't like. And the civil rights crowd didn't like the elite blacks. And they started bad-mouthing him. And that's when the White Citizen Council down south found out he was a black man. And they boycotted his products.
Yep, I read that.
Yeah. And the thing is, it almost bankrupted him. He had to go into bankruptcy. But the same thing is happening to Kanye West now. You know, he made some statements about the Jews and George Floyd. And the thing is, you know, J.P. Morgan Chase told him he had to get $140-some million out of their bank. They didn't want his business anymore. And all of his all of the companies that he had business with, Adidas and all of them, is saying that, hey, look, they don't want any association with him anymore. In fact, a fourth of all of Adidas's revenue comes from Kanye West's products. So he's in the process now, probably they're trying to destroy him all the way down. But the thing is, I didn't know it was worth $2 to $3 billion personally.
Yeah, I knew it was a billion. He was a billionaire.
He's the richest black man.
Richest black man where?
I'm, he's the richest black man in America. Now, I don't know how long this...
Well, I'm going to have to study up on him for tomorrow or this week.
Yeah, I'm gonna send you some stuff on it. I'm gonna send you some stuff on it.
Okay.
But anyway, but look at what they did to S.B. Fuller, and look at what they're doing to Kanye. And you know, you got a program scheduled for tomorrow, so I'll send it to you after tomorrow's program.
Okay, I appreciate it. All right,
yeah,
man, we're gonna wrap up. All right, same here.